miserable, and I am not a sinner.
Maybe it's something as simple as you whistle while you work.
Just whistle while you work.
So far, Pastor Haggard, you've kept that commandment perfectly today.
So far today, that particular one, yes.
The fact is, I am guilty of sexual immorality.
Happy Ramadan, Abdul.
Well, the New York Times headline of Monday read, "Ancient Tablet Ignites Debate on Messiah and Resurrection." Apparently something was found, an inscription or a writing of some sort on a tablet in the Holy Land, and at least the New York Times is quoting scholars as saying that it might shake up our entire view of Christianity and where it came from. I'm Todd Wilkin. Welcome to Issues Etc. We're coming to you live this Tuesday, the 8th of July. You can join us with questions or comments as Dr. Jeff Kloa joins us to talk about the discovery of this stone tablet with an alleged reference to a suffering, dying, and rising Messiah that predates the New Testament. Talk back at issuesetc.org. Talk back at issuesetc.org. Coming up in the second part of this first hour, we'll do a little audio open lines talking with you via email and the phones. We'll be talking about a CNN story about religious license plates. Two states have attempted to have overtly religious Christian license plates, and one of them's been knocked down. The other one is facing a court challenge. We'll also talk about an NPR report on the Church of England and their decision to ordain female bishops. They've always had female clergy, but female bishops is a new thing for the Church of England. They're latecomers to that particular party in worldwide Anglicanism. On the subject of Anglicanism, in the second hour of the program, Bishop Keith Ackerman will join us, a regular guest, Bishop of the Episcopal Diocese of Quincy, Illinois. We'll talk about next week's big meeting of worldwide Anglican leaders. It's called Lambeth. And then Scott Klusendorf will join us to round off the program. We'll be defending the pro-life position with Scott Klusendorf of Life Training Institute in the last 45 minutes of Issues Etc. Our in-studio email address, talkback@issuesetc.org. talkback@issuesetc.org. Dr. Jeff Kloa is Associate Professor of New Testament at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis and a regular guest here on the program. Dr. Kloa, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Well, thanks. Good to have you back again.
So far as you can tell, does this discovery of a tablet with writing on it threaten to overturn or shake up our view of Christianity, as a scholar quoted in the New York Times suggests?
Well, yeah, it sort of reminded me. I saw the headline actually Sunday on the New York Times website, and immediately thought of the family tomb of Jesus, which of course was supposed to completely overturn Christianity. And the year before that, it was the Gospel of Judas, which was supposed to completely overturn Christianity. And here we have now this text, which has been reinterpreted and missing words filled in, which purports to, at least according to one scholar, completely overturn Christianity. It's amazing how similar these all are in their method of argumentation. I have to say this one is well, the family tomb is tenuous, but this is a pretty tenuous argument at best.
Do you have any reason or anything reported in the press that would lead you to believe that this may be a less than authentic discovery?
Well, it's similar to the issue with the Gospel of Judas text. I mean, the manuscript is an actual manuscript, a third century manuscript that was discovered of Judas, and the only question was the interpretation of the text. Similarly, with this text, which was discovered, there's no question as to the authenticity. It hasn't been claimed to be a forgery, such as the James ossuary of a few years back. As far as we can tell, scholars can tell, it's an authentic text, probably dated to the first century BC. There's some question about its find, as most of these archaeological discoveries tend to be. People tend to not want to disclose where they were found, lest other discoveries be taken away, so they try to keep them to themselves. So, you know, we don't know exactly where it's from. It's been known for some time. It's only recently been translated and published and now sort of reinterpreted by this Jewish scholar. So in terms of the, is it an actual Jewish text from the first century B.C., really that's, I don't think, in question. The only question is, what's the significance of the text?
So let's talk about the find itself. A stone tablet, unusual in this respect, it seems, that it, rather than having words inscribed into it, it appears to have had words written on it.
Right.
Is it associated with the other Qumran findings, the other findings of the Dead Sea Scrolls?
Right. That's some of the speculation. It seems to fit the same time period and the same general Transjordan location. Again, because the provenance is unknown, it was, you know, sold on the black market sort of thing, as these typically are. If they're not ending up in museums, it's in the hands of a private collector now. So, you know, where it came from exactly, was it found in one of the caves? There's just no way to know, really, at this point. The speculation is that it's somehow connected to the Dead Sea Scrolls materials.
What is the actual text? Is it a biblical inscription? Is it something else?
Well, that's the interesting thing. I took a read through the text here. It's actually 87 lines of text in two columns. As you said, written or painted almost on the stone, face of the stone, rather than inscribed, which is rather unusual. And it seems to be, it's given the name, Gabriel's Vision, although there is no title to the text, that the top of it's broken off, the bottom of it is incomplete, so there's no title actually on the text itself. And it really is a, it's hard to describe. There's no really narrative to it. It seems to describe different biblical characters, people like David, Ephraim come up, Michael the angel is mentioned, Gabriel the angel is mentioned. There's things about messengers and angels and lots of threes going on. And something about Israel being vindicated by Yahweh is basically the theme of the text, that Israel is suffering. But Yahweh will come to the aid of his people somehow. So that's the basic theme of the text, although there's no narrative, there's no story that's ascertainable in the text right now.
Now, what's the interpretation that's being put on it by those who are bringing this discovery back to the fore again?
Right. Well, the key here is there's actually one person who is promoting this interpretation. The stone tablet was really sort of brought out in public, you might say, in the February issue of Biblical Archaeological Review, who released both the Hebrew transcription and an English translation. No mention at all in that article of the connection to any sort of messianic figure or anything like this. The one scholar in question is named Israel Knoll, K-N-O-H-L. I tried to track down a little bit. I don't know a lot about him. He seems to have an interest in promoting Jewishness. In fact, his controversial article appeared on in a Jewish newspaper, that newspaper's Jewish website, which might tend to call into question a little bit its goals and aims. But it's one scholar who is interpreting essentially one line of the text in his own unique way to make the connection to a messianic figure who he claims is commanded to rise from the dead. It might be helpful just to actually read the three lines as it's given, or the two lines as it's given in the initial English translation.
Please do.
It says this. It says, in 3 days, missing text, I, Gabriel, missing text, the Prince of Princes, missing text, narrow holes, missing text. Now, the way the, and that's from the, initial editors of the text. Israel Knoll commends the editors for their careful work. However, he thinks he can see letters and words that the original editors don't see, and he fills in the blanks in a pretty specific way. Now let me find the exact reference here because I want to quote him directly. He says, in 3 days, and then you fill in the blank with a command, live, he says. Then the I, Gabriel, fill in the blank, command you, he says, prince of princes, then becomes the object of that verb, and he takes narrow holes to be not narrow holes like a cave, but a rocky ravine, and that's a somewhat significant thing. So all you have in the text is literally 3 days, Gabriel, prince of princes, and there's no indication in the stone what the grammatical relationship between those is. What this scholar has done is supplied verbs in order to make sense of the text, and says that in 3 days, rise. So Gabriel is essentially commanding whoever is mentioned in this text to rise. He takes it from the dead. And then the Prince of Princes is vindicated from having died, he claims, in the narrow hole or the rocky ravine.
When we come back from this break, we're going to continue our conversation with Dr. Jeff Kloa, Associate Professor of New Testament at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. We're discussing this discovery of a stone tablet with an alleged description of a suffering and resurrected Messiah. Some, perhaps only one, is contending that this should cause us to rethink the origins of Christianity. We'll find out whether that is warranted, and more to the point, whether or not the concept of a suffering, dying, and rising Messiah is unknown in the Old Testament, as the scholar in question seems to assert. You can join us with questions or comments. We're coming to you live this Tuesday. It's the 8th of July. Our in-studio email address, talkback@issuesetc.org. talkback@issuesetc.org. Dr. Jeff Kloa is Associate Professor of New Testament at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis. After about 10 more minutes of conversation with him, we'll have audio open lines, a CNN story about religious license plates, and the Church of England, finally at long last, coming late to the party of ordaining female bishops. We'll be right back.
Sounds of rich liturgy and historic Christian worship. What a way to spend a Sunday morning. At Trinity Lutheran Church in Millstadt, Illinois, you'll find authentic Christianity as you hear the preaching of Christ crucified for the forgiveness of your sins. Come, join us Sunday mornings at 9 and Monday evenings at 7:30, and find out more about Trinity Lutheran Church, Millstadt, Illinois, at trinitymillstadt.org.
On behalf of the staff of Issues, etc., thanks to each and every one of the more than 7,500 who signed the online petition to bring Issues, etc. back. Tamara Akri, Maria Heimbigner, Pastor John Fram III, Pastor Stephen Tibbetts, Robin Lee, Pastor Ronald Rowland, Ken Sperduso, Jacob Wolmer, Randall Mensch, and Pastor Burton Greenway. Thanks for your support.
Defending the Faith. Teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues, etc.
618-223-8384. It's the new phone number for the Issues, etc. listener comment line. 618-223-8384. Leery about calling a live radio talk show? Want to remain anonymous? Leave your recorded question or comment on the Issues, etc. comment line. 618-223-8384. The good, the bad, the ugly. We're big boys. We can take it. 618-223-8384.
Did you know that you can listen to Issues Etc. 24/7? Check out our website, issuesetc.org, and click on-demand audio. Listen at the gym, in your kitchen, in your garden, on your iPod, your computer, or in your car. The technology may be new, but the truth never changes. Issues Etc. on-demand audio, available for your convenience at issuesetc.org. 10 hours of new programming each week. issuesetc.org, and click on-demand audio.
Okay, so what we have so far is some questionable scholarship filling in the blanks on this albeit ancient tablet with some Hebrew writing on it. Some creative scholarship, if you will. What's being asserted is that the traditional and Old Testament view of the Messiah is very different from the suffering, dying, rising Messiah that has been adopted by Christianity. That's what's being asserted. We'll find out whether or not that's true. Dr. Jeff Kloa, Associate Professor of New Testament at Concordia Seminary, is our guest. I'm Todd Wilkin. Dr. Kloa, there's a line in here in the New York Times piece that is quoting from Israel Knoll, the scholar in question, where it says A suffering Messiah is very different from the traditional Jewish image of the Messiah as a triumphal, powerful descendant of King David. It seems to be asserted that somehow this idea of a suffering, dying, and rising Messiah was introduced and that Jesus and his disciples thought it was a keen idea and took it up. Is there a concept of a suffering, dying, and rising Messiah in the Old Testament?
Well, Knoll is somewhat correct. He's referring to intertestamental Judaism. When you look at discussions of Messiah and references to Messiah in intertestamental texts from the Jewish, whatever stripe of Judaism you're talking about, there are various interpretations of what the Messiah will do. In some, he's a Davidic king that restores the kingdom to Israel. In some, he's a Messiah who comes and restores the temple, which had been sort of corrupted in the time before Jesus. Some think the Messiah will come and produce this sort of time of plenty and abundance. Some think the Messiah will come and teach the law perfectly, and people will be able to keep the law, the Torah. But what you do not find is the Old Testament themes, Isaiah 52 primarily, and 53 especially, regarding the Messiah, the servant who comes and suffers for his people. So Canolis is correct in his description of what Judaism of the time just before Jesus is thinking about Messiah. They seem to have not picked up on Old Testament themes, prophecies of the dying Messiah, which are fulfilled in Jesus.
So for Christianity, the various facets of the messianic figure that are described in the Old Testament
mm-hmm.
are not considered to be contradictory with one another.
Wait, say that again. I'm not sure I got
well,
the question right.
Well, in the Old Testament, we have these various facets of the Messiah figure.
Right.
Son of David, triumphal
son of David,
king.
Prophet, priest, and king. Right,
and then
exactly.
Suffering servant.
Right.
Are these considered to be in conflict with one another according to Christian scholarship of the Old Testament?
Well, it is fair to say that it's only, maybe the better way to put it is this. You don't know what Messiah is until he actually shows up. So Jesus pretty clearly defines what Messiah is and does the work of Messiah. He redoes Israel. He does the work of the servant. He dies for his people. So he fulfills it. In a sense, it would be difficult to expect a first century Jewish person, given their political situation, religious situation, to have seen the figure of Jesus of Nazareth and immediately known that this was the Messiah. In fact, that's what you see in the Gospels. Most people can't possibly think he's the Messiah. And when Peter confesses him as the Christ, and then Jesus says, yes, I'm the Christ, and I'm going to die on the cross, Peter says, get behind me, Satan. He can't conceive of a dying Messiah. So New Testament scholars would say it's not contradictory. It's just made clear once the Messiah actually shows up. In a sense, the nation of Israel almost didn't have a chance. It would have been extremely challenging to see Jesus as what they would have looked for in a Messiah.
To be fair, there were also other messianic figures and movements, not genuine messianic, but I say messianic small m, figures and movements in the intertestamental and the New Testament
certainly.
Period, weren't there?
Right, but they would be picking up on the themes that Israel would be looking for at the time. Some are going to restore the temple. The Essenes are, in fact, looking for, apparently, two messiahs, one who would sort of lead the community and one who would restore the temple. There might be also a political messiah. But they're tending to look, we might say, sort of short-term in terms of what messiah would be. They're not thinking eschatological salvation of all of God's people for all time. It tends to be a rather short-sighted, here's our problem, here's what Messiah is going to do, and he's going to solve our problem, rather than the whole sort of narrative sweep of biblical eschatology that Jesus is the answer and the hinge point for all of creation in the past and restoration in the future.
I mean, even for the New Testament church in its very earliest days, there seems to be some tension about the scope of Christ's atoning work, whether it was Israel per se or the world and the Gentile nations, isn't there?
Oh, yes, certainly. You might argue that the Gospel of Matthew was intended to encourage a Gentile mission among the Jews. And, of course, the book of Galatians, you see in Acts 15 a question of are the Gentiles included in this act of God's restoration, or how are they included, what's their role. So, there's certainly tension, even after, Pentecost, as to how exactly everybody fits into this answer of God.
On the issue of archaeological discoveries in general, Dr. Kloa, these things tend to take a while to filter to the popular media, and when they get there, it's often in this kind of form. One guy putting his own spin on something that the rest of the reputable scholarly community are not willing to go so far. How is the average person to digest, without going to all the professional journals, how are they to digest these new discoveries that seem to kind of crop up about once a year?
Right. I guess I would tend to say don't read the article. I mean, I hate to say it that way, but you're exactly right. Things tend to be sensationalized immediately, and it's rather interesting the way biblical scholarship has turned in the last, 20, 30 years. I'm not that old, but you read scholars from back in the, 19th century, early 20th century, and what tended to happen is a person would spend their whole career working on a topic, and they reach retirement age, and they produce their magnum opus and summarizes a whole lifetime of digesting the material and a very mature thought. What tends to happen now is biblical scholarship is somewhat, celebritized, and people are interested in getting their name out, and that's what tends to lead to publication and notoriety and things like this. And so almost the more sensational you can make something, the more likely you are to make a name for yourself and then establish your, popularity and in that way somehow your credentials. What's tended to happen, unfortunately, is scholars have had to take a step back after doing this. A classic example is this now Gospel of Judas. If you recall, a couple of years ago, we heard that Judas was a hero of the gospel. It turns out now that the translation was done perhaps a little bit too hastily or a little bit too with a certain agenda in mind, and some phrases, lines, were in fact completely mistranslated. And we now know that Judas is not the hero of the gospel. He's a buffoon. He messes up. He's a negative figure in the gospel, and it's a completely anti-Christian document. And in fact, there's a lot of hurt feelings if you go through the web discussions of these things and scholars discussing these things online. Unfortunately, it's. Throw it out and then let's assess, rather than let's assess and come to some firm conclusions before this comes out.
With only about a minute here before we close up, it seems as though all of this is compounded by the tendency for, I think, less than scholarly authors to offer popularly written books to the general public that put their own, not just scholarly spin, but sometimes their own theological spins on things that may in other respects be perfectly legitimate archaeological discoveries. Talk about that 1 minute.
Yeah. You're probably referencing things like misquoting Jesus or books like this.
Sure.
Right. It's, he's using actual data in that book, and some of his arguments, a lot of his arguments are pretty good. The real question is, how do you incorporate the little details into the larger picture historically and theologically? And that's where I think more caution needs to be exhibited than we typically find in scholarly work today. That there's an interest, again, in just being a bit sensational for its own sake, in a sense, and let the pieces get sorted out later on. If you're the first one to posit something, then you're the one that everybody else has to refer to. And that's not real helpful for the average person who isn't equipped to go through all this stuff and sort through it all, doesn't have the time or the inclination. It tends to simply confuse rather than clarify, and that's just not really helpful.
Dr. Jeff Kloa is Associate Professor of New Testament at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis. Dr. Kloa, thanks for being our guest on Issues, Etc.
Take care.
When we come back from this break, we've got open lines for your questions, your comments. You can give us a call, our toll-free number 877-623-6648. 877-623-6943. That's 877-623-MYIE. And our in-studio email address, live this Tuesday, the 8th of July, talkback at issuesetc.org. It's audio open lines. We've got some audio to play for you from CNN. I would not be able to tell you what my license plate on either one of my cars is. I don't have it memorized. Now, some people have vanity license plates. They get to put their own little spin on whatever the license plate says. And now there's a kind of license plate, at least it's been attempted in two states, that is overtly religious, some say Christian. Is that where you should wear your faith, on your license plate? We'll hear a story from CNN during audio open lines right after this break. You're listening to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin.
Contending for the truth in an age of anti-truth, you're listening to Issues Etc.
Issues Etc. is listener-supported. That means we rely on you for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Hi, this is Todd Wilkin. Please consider making a gift to Issues Etc. today. You can donate online, issuesetc.org, or by check, Issues Etc., Box 1046, SJC, California, 92693. Box 1046, SJC, California, 92693. Thanks for your support of Issues Etc.
On behalf of the staff of Issues Etc., thanks to each and every one of the more than 7,500 who signed the online petition to bring back Issues Etc. Megan Zapita, Joe Harwell, Pastor Richard Anderay, Tracy Rolandelli, Michael Green, Pastor Robert Frank, Rachel Engebretson, Barb Kavoris, Ryan Patterson, and Pastor Theodore Staudacher. Thanks for your support.